This is the evening forum, and the title of it is The Violent Christian. I'm Melissa Maxwell Doherty. I'm from Grand Forks, North Dakota. And I am going to ask us to a question. But before I do that, I want to tell you how this started. This is my unartistic rendition of a squirt gun. Earlier this week, there were a lot of squirt guns. They started last week, and they kind of multiplied like rabbits. And some people, adults, got alarmed because what they saw fun, you know, kids playing with water, and it was one of those really, really hot days, and that was great. But what they also saw was a power differentiation. The big kids were lording it over the little boogers. The little boogers who couldn't get into the play were taking sticks and at each other, and this prompted a Sunday night conversation among some of the teaching staff, and hence this conversation. And even though I'm absolutely spatially challenged, I still like pictures. And when I think of this topic, I think of me. You know, it's easy for me to point fingers, say, you know, everybody else is a violent Christian as opposed to me. And I would say that I'm kind of a peaceful person. At least I always thought that I was until I had children. And I discovered rage, absolute rage, that would bubble up in me. And I had to kind of deal with that in a tough way. When I think of my household, how my whole household, how we are violent, how we have that aggression in us, our neighborhood, and then all the way out to the global community. Just to kind of get to know who we are, you don't have to necessarily say your name, but you can if you like. But what prompts you to be here as opposed to the lift? What is it about this topic that interests you, piques your interest? That might help kind of throw that out, because I don't know that we have any expert in the room here on violence. We have a theologian, a systematic theologian, which is helpful. But other than that, it's us. So if you'd begin, what prompts you?
Mostly I was looking for your parents to see where our children were, but
you're here to raise save me. This is my husband, Scott.
I'm Martin, and I'm a violent Christian.
Hi, Martin.
I'm here because I'm frightened by not just actual physical violence, but what I see is an increasingly violent cultural clash that's going on. That's emotional and psychological, and it really feels to me like our culture is sorting through big power issues, and we're being violent in lots and lots of ways, and it's very disturbing to me.
Oh, I'm Laurel, and my curiosity was really piqued. I thought this was going to be about the NRA, something like that, but also, I would say the most hurtful, damaging, violent things that have happened to me in my life, especially in the last 10 years, have been perpetrated by people in the church. And so, that's what I thought I'd check it out.
I'm Jane, and I didn't have any major decision other than I didn't think I could get into it, and I thought it would be a very interesting time. And I'm children.
I'm Tim. After the movie of Day After Trinity the other evening, and kind of how we finished that, it just didn't seem to finish to me, and it raised a lot of questions, and I thought this would probably be a place to continue conversation.
And it's increasingly important subject, and as you mentioned, being a parent, and I always felt I was not a valid person. I didn't have those feelings, but my child certainly brought that.
So yes, it is. I mean, it comes right to me. It comes down.
My name is John, and I'm particularly interested in the topic. I just finished reading this book just 2 days ago called The American Religion by Harold Bloom. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and it's an absolutely, you know, fascinating book. And among many points he makes, one of them is the point that he says that the typical American spirituality is so self-oriented. And it skips right from the virgin birth, you know, to heaven, and forgets about everything in between. And one of his theses was that American religion has kind of a natural alliance with American violence. And you know, so there's a lot entailed in that, you know, so I've been thinking a lot about that.
I'm Elise, and I just came out of general interest.
I'm Marianne. Came because I was with her.
Oh, well, I was a student in Germany in 1955 when a friend who had invited me to his home in Darmstadt, and I were walking into the apartment building, and he looked in a toy store and saw for the first time in Germany, in his sight at least, weapons as toys. And he immediately went into the store and had a fairly confrontational conversation with the owner, whom he knew personally. And I remember it so vividly because it was the very first time in my life that the whole question of Christianity and violence was raised for me. It seems to me fairly clear, every layer of the New Testament is utterly, utterly consistent that the Messianic age inaugurated by Jesus is the very antithesis of violence, and it's also the most consistently ignored dimension of the New Testament. And I came tonight just to see whether we could get some clarity inconsistency, incongruity, the clarity of the teaching of the New Testament, and the almost total failure of the Christian community to pay any attention to that teaching.
Mine's general interest, but it sort of expresses my feelings, you know, that it's so incongruent with what I read and what I see.
I think there is Christian violence, and I want to hear how much is recognized and how we might deal with it.
My name is Janet, and I came because I'm a director here at Holden, one of the directors, and I think Holden stands to be a witness for peace, and how I want to be part of the conversation. Context as well as a personal one.
Smith, the violent Christian should be an oxymoron, but I'm afraid it's not. Mm-hmm. That got my curiosity, and I need better hair than you.
Better
lights,
huh?
I'm Carl, and I came just because of interest in this topic, and people touched on many reasons that are similar to mine, the incongruity, for one thing, but also, you know, we have from, say, the Christian right, we have certainly outspoken violence, either in the rhetoric or maybe even beyond that. I've heard statements like homosexuals should burn in hell, and that does not, that kind of thing is troubling. And the other thing too, though, is that despite my desire for peaceableness, opposition to death penalty, I hear about a particularly brutal crime. The person who committed that crime ceases to be a human being to me. I mean, in the sense that I just feel a violent reaction toward that individual. That's very difficult. At that point, I understand the impulse toward death penalty when a really brutal crime that I hear about occurs. And it's and that's something very difficult to deal with, because I then react in violent ways towards that. And I'm dehumanized by that particular crime.
I realized, and I guess it was the oxymoron in the title that got my interest, but also being a mom, I know what's in me. I'm not always peaceable and gentle with my own children.
My name is Chuck, and I guess I'm here because I think I'm schizophrenic. Theoretically, I recognized you a need for military preparedness or power in a fallen world. But I think for myself personally, I'm a pacifist, and I don't think I would shoot or kill anybody. And so I feel kind of schizophrenic about that. And then I'm sure that there's subtle forms of violence in my own life, too, that I can recognize. And the way you laid that out suggests that kind of opens us up a little broader than what I thought it was going to be.
I'm Ruth, and I just was kind of in hopes that might hear some sort of solutions. We live in Tacoma, and it seems to make the headlines all the time, this murder and that murder and everything. Just time to start seeing what we can do to stop some of this, change it, break the cycle.
And Ralph, and your general curiosity. The last forum we went to was very thought-provoking.
I'm Stephen Yarnell from Seattle, and when I was in college, I became a conscientious objector and felt that the issue we're discussing tonight was one of the critical issues to deal with, and how do Christians deal with what we perceive as evil. And I didn't have the answers, I don't know, but it seemed that violence was one of the ways that we should move against as a Christian community. And Walt, I was involved in Seattle in a No War Toys movement in the 1960s. It was spectacularly unsuccessful.
I'm Mary Yarnell, and I was intrigued by the title. I also thought that it was a contradiction in terms of violent Christian. And yet, when I think about Christianity and its history, it has a tremendous amount of violence, and even today, violence justified. And I wanted to get some sort of insight into how Christians justify violence, so that I can in some way oppose it. That's what intrigued me.
And I'm Tom Arnold, and like everyone else, have similar interests and was interested by the title. And I guess one part upon reflection that I wonder about is clearly this has been a historical phenomenon, like Mary said, and also a global phenomenon. But to what extent is there, if at all, is there perhaps a unique form of American Christian violence? Is there some particular blending that takes place in America because of our own history and so forth, and also perhaps the role of the media in that, the way Christianity seems, most religions seem to get headlines in the media when something really bad happens in the name of some religion, to what extent there may be an interdependent cause-effect relationship between that.
We're saying kind of what brought us here tonight for this topic.
We're saying what brought us here tonight for this topic.
I'm Catherine Lee. I'm very much concerned about just our vile society, in especially, of course, in the United States. And I'm concerned being a Christian because I quite often get violent feelings when I hear certain speakers or programs, and then I realize that I'm feeling just as antagonistic and bitter as they sound, and that's very disturbing. And I think our swing in our nation toward the death penalty is an ethical question, which Christians need to, especially Christians need to consider and deliberate on what is our response to that.
I'm Sylvia, and I'm here as a listener.
I'm Ellie, and I'm here to see which direction this discussion would go. I think it's a really, it's very big, and it's, I think a lot of people don't know alternatives when they look back, and there's so much pain.
Mm-hmm. I'm Lenora, and I'm very concerned about it too, and which way I should react.
Gallery.
It's cool up here where I'm being a loser. My name's Doug. I guess the title caught me partly. Partly I'm concerned about our reaction to it. From my standpoint, they say 5% of crimes are committed by repeat offenders. We're not doing the job somehow, doing that kind of job. And our reaction as a government to it, and as a society, is to limit the people who are already law-abiding in all kinds of levels. And I'm concerned about that.
My name is Warren, and always interested in good dialogue.
I'm Jan. Interesting topic, and I think there's a lot of violence associated around
Well, I'm sorry. My name's Betty, and I'm concerned about it, but I'm listening.
If I could take all those things and kind of summarize, and then we'll just open it for a free-for-all. Many people have a concern, the whole oxymoron, and we can thank Flo, our artist. I think she was the one with the very clever title, The Violent Christian, and how we reconcile that with the witness of the gospel. And yet what we know to be the violence within ourselves and the Christian community. Talk about our culture, the Christian right, the Christian left, and all the Christian middle. What we do, how can we change? How can we make a difference? So I just open it out at this point and have dialogue back and forth.
A question, where has the softening come? And as a theologian watching a historical process, where has the softening come in delivering the gospel that says, this is who we are, this is who God has called us to be, and historically, where has that been drained away, and why, if you've got a perspective on that?
I think some simple things can be said quickly. For the first three centuries, Christians basically did not participate in
the military or in the Roman police, after Constantine, most of the people who ran the empire were Christians, as well as people in charge of power. And now they were confronted with dilemmas. Government is about power, almost automatically, so that when Christians came to be in charge of government, they had to address how they were going to deal with power. In the Middle Ages, they developed then the notion of justifiable violence, and it worked reasonably well, partly because in the whole feudal system, people only gave their feudal lords 40 fighting days. So if you didn't topple a castle or beat an army in 40 days, everybody just went home. And so it worked reasonably well. And the criteria for justifiable violence were fairly universally taught and observed. The one great problem was, of course, that this was Christians dealing with other Christians, and one of the truly questionable developments is that no similar restraints were felt in relationship between Christians and non-Christians, so that the crusade mentality justified almost any kind of violence against the infidel. And similarly, in the Middle Ages, Christians developed fairly violent ways of responding to Jews in their society. Some later and more sinister developments came around the 9th and 10th centuries, when people were converted to Christianity by violence. St. Olaf had a very simple evangelism technique. Confess Christ or be killed. And so the Norwegians very quickly decided that it was better to confess Christ than the Danes and all kinds of other Northern Europeans. The Russians did the same thing. We just observed Olga and Vladimir's day. And Vladimir converted the Russians at the turn of the millennium simply by giving them the option to confess Christ or die. I think that those kinds of developments began to help Christians live fairly comfortably with violence. And by the time of the Reformation, the just war theory was still in place. It's in the Augsburg Confession in Article 16. But I doubt whether most Lutherans have ever heard even what the criteria are for justifiable violence. And what has replaced that has been the assumption that the state has a claim upon us to support police powers and to support militant defense. And Lutherans have understood themselves mostly to be law-abiding citizens who therefore have not asked questions about police power or about the defense of the country. And it would be very difficult to apply the criteria of justifiable violence to most of the wars we have fought, but Lutherans have hardly ever raised any questions about that. I think only recently have people once again been raising the question of the old Middle Ages justifiable violence notion, and it would be interesting to see them applied once again, or at least to see them taught. We may not want to apply them, but we might at least ask ourselves what is involved here. The peace churches have had a historic witness. Mennonites and Quakers, friends,
but they've been usually dismissed as irrelevant in violent cultures and violent situations. And I don't think that we've done a particularly good job of understanding ourselves in anything other than violent terms. I want to add one final point. One of the things that Calvin did was to reassert the importance and the significance of the Old Testament for Christians. And a lot of traditions that take their cues from Calvin justify violent attitudes toward criminals, toward enemies of any kind, toward sinners. A lot of what I heard tonight comes out of that kind of fundamentally Calvinist tradition. And that's been, I think, intensified in the United States by a frontier mentality that combined with frontier religion. I referred to Harold Bloom's book this morning. I think it's one of the most fascinating books I've read in the last 5 years. And he links American religion or American Christian religion and violence fairly directly. He calls it the flag and the fetus syndrome and a few other things. So America is essentially a kind of American religion grows out of the seedbed of Calvinism. I don't want to exonerate Luther at this point because his language was violent, his last year's treatment of Jews was despicable, and he himself was responsible for at least the attempt to get justifiable violence into the Lutheran tradition, but it is still violence.
Maybe it'd be useful to have a definition of violence. Sort of like a working definition. If you're attacked and you respond, is that violence? If your family is attacked, if your country, I mean, there's a whole range from, well, like this thing you got going up here, from global wars, the biggest one you've had, World War II, down to an invader in your house. Where some you have time to think about it, some you don't have time to think about it. Your children are being stabbed to death. Are you justified? Can you, as a person, stand and watch that? Is it right to stand and watch that? The other thing that my wife came up here and came around and said, don't forget to say, I'm not saying, but don't forget to say, that we as the Lutheran Church, at least I have not seen a social statement that says otherwise, condone, as far as my wife and I are concerned, one of the most violent acts in the world, and that's abortion.
That's what?
Abortion. That is the ultimate act of violence. It's a completely innocent being. That is killed.
That raises, for me, the question, does violence have anything to do with guilt and innocence? Is there a connection there? I'm not sure there is.
Say more.
Yeah.
I don't want to, the abortion issue is not what's on the table here. It's certainly one piece of the discussion, but I think violence is violence is violence. I've never been involved in abortion in any kind of personal way, and yet I've certainly been involved in violence and would consider myself as guilty of violence as somebody who who would participate in abortion in whatever way. So as we talk about violence and our faith, I would hope we don't get stuck in one kind of discussion or another. It's just too broad of a discussion.
If we were going to add to it a definition of violence, and I don't have a word that necessarily describes this that comes to my mind, but violence begets, is that appropriate? I in our neighborhood, it's been interesting to watch as these super soaker things, you know, goes back to the Holden thing, but one kid one day, there's a lot of boys too, have just your basic squirt gun, just, you know, 9 inches. Well, then about a week later, somebody else has the, shoots 20 foot. We don't have a backpack on our block yet, but I wouldn't be surprised if it's there.
There was a backpack.
It grows. Oh yeah, here. I'm talking about North Dakota, just in my little slice of a neighborhood. How it grows, and you one up, you know. It just kind of starts.
Well, the other night out here, I wanted to get the hose.
You want to
get the hose out and, you know, teach these kids a lesson.
Okay, you wanted to deal with their violence violently.
Yeah. You kids quit picking on the other kids here.
I think when we talk about violence of killing people and so on, I think the most violence, I believe, occurs right in the home. It occurs between spouses, children and parents, and I think that that's where the setting begins.
When you have those stories about something happens at work, so you go home, you kick the dog, and
right. You don't just kick the dog.
Yes. I live in Winnipeg, and there's huge Mennonite population in Winnipeg. I think there are 50 Mennonite churches in Winnipeg, and they're all full. And they condone their anti, you know, they would never join the military. They're very, that's part of their background. However, there was a survey done in the last couple of years on the amount of spousal abuse, mostly wife abuse, in Mennonite homes. It is just amazing. And I was just shocked. I have several Mennonite friends. And there's also Hutterite colonies around there. And if you know the Hutterites, they're still a little more back in the old style, you know, or like the Amish pasta. And I would wonder, you know, I'm not making a statement here, I'm just sort of wondering where the abuse occurs in the home or the violence in the home. And yet we say we're against violence, but it's part of human nature in some ways. Maybe, I don't know. But that was pretty scary for me to read that. My friends, the Mennonites, had that kind of a survey, the result of the survey.
Maybe it would be helpful to try and go right to the core and ask the question, why am I violent? What prompts violence in each of us? I think I got some insight into that at one point in my training when I realized that my violence comes in response to fear. Anger for me, which can lead and has led to violence, is not, that's the surface issue, but it's usually not what's really driving me. And I think I've made a little bit of progress towards understanding my own violence if I can't catch myself fast enough to ask, what am I afraid of? Why, what's really driving me? Because I think for me, anger and violence have been a kind of, it's kind of like eating a candy bar when you're really hungry. You know it won't solve your hunger problem, but it's sort of fast and it gives you a quick fix. And I think for me, anger has given me a certain power in what feels like otherwise a powerless situation, which makes me afraid. And so if I can catch it at that phase, sometimes I'm a little bit ahead. I don't know how it works for others, but that has been helpful for me.
I'm very concerned about what Jesus said and how he acted in speaking to violence. As he spoke about turning the other cheek and loving your enemies, and how he himself exemplified this kind of nonviolence, at the same time showing tremendous power and lasting influence and strength. But he was a peaceful person.
What do you think enabled him to do that?
Pardon me?
What do you think enabled him to do that? Did he have no fear?
Well, that's or, you know, what I would,
what
yes.
What motivated him? Well, the easy answer would be, well, he's God, but
no.
But there's more.
Yeah, I think that's a very important
Jesus
point. I think that he didn't fear his enemies. He didn't fear. He did not return from the cross, but he didn't. He didn't fear or flee from it. So that gave him the strength to be a peaceful person.
Well, I think there have been other people who have not been afraid for their own life. But like the gentleman up there, if somebody starts attacking your family, whatever that may be, what do you do then? Do you fear for them or not?
I think along that line, the most clear-cut case I can think of, if the world hadn't reacted against violence with violence, there would not be a Jew alive in the world today from the Second World War. There would not be one surviving. And some lady the other day, I don't know if she's here, mentioned gypsies. Anybody with any kind of infirmity, basically anybody without blonde hair and blue eyes would be around. If we hadn't reacted with some kind of violence. And that speaks to the justifiable war.
But doesn't that assume that violence is the only form of power that's effective?
It can't be timeless.
That also assumes you can draw certain lines, because it's always easy to say we need to do this in defense, or those are bad guys. And so much of the violence comes from scapegoating and dehumanizing others. And you can, you know, dehumanize abortion doctors, or you can dehumanize gypsies. And if your standard of measuring when you can be violent, if that's real fluid, you know, that can lead to just about anything. You know, there are people who legitimately believe they should be bombing abortion clinics to save people, or that they should be murdering black men to save their white wives. You know, that was legitimate violence.
You brought up fear and anger, and I think you shouldn't confuse anger and violence. Because there are times anger is appropriate. It's what you do with that anger that can turn it into violence. And I was also thinking, Christ had a moment where he whipped the money changers out of the temple. And that wasn't exactly a peaceful event. How do you interpret what happened there? I'm not saying violence is okay, but to say that Christ was always peaceful is not accurate either. there was a time he felt the action was appropriate.
I don't know, then, Walt, maybe you can help me, because this was a lecture that I only remember part of. And what I took away was that there are two words in the New Testament for anger. One is thumos, and one is something else. And one of them meant righteous anger, i.e. Jesus in the temple. And the other was an anger that defaces, dehumanize. If I said to Martin, you know, anybody with half a brain wouldn't leave the towel on the floor. You know, that kind of ripping his person. Does this, is that, can you fill the rest of that lecture? You didn't give it though, but it's just, half of that stuck in there.
So I think about, like with my kids, there's times I get out of control and it's scary to me. And it's because I am angry with them, probably for a good reason, but I don't know quite how to cope with that anger sometimes. And when it gets out of hand, and it escalates, and we have a mess for a few minutes until we all cool off. Just at the very domestic level of things.
So all that affects, it ripples out. Ooh, somebody over here said what happens in the home ripples out everywhere.
I think violence is excessive use of force. I mean, where it goes beyond any kind of appropriate response, it just being pure brutality is kind of violence for its own sake. That would, and we can think of the way we can think of the way genocide is an example that just goes.
Speak up just a little bit louder. I'm sorry, I can't hear you.
Genocide is a good example of that. And what I'm saying is the criteria for violence is just simply excessive behavior where it goes beyond anything that's reasonable at all. And we can think of the response to the Native Americans or the indigenous peoples in North America would even be a better term. We can think of the even response to the natural world. The way wolves were shot out in the West went beyond all reason. It was a pure bloodbath. It just became pure bloodlust. They were sending bounty hunters up in Montana, up into the Bitterroot Range, where they weren't even sending cattle at the time, and killing wolves, dynamiting their dens. I think, this kind of behavior dehumanizes us. The same kind of violence towards other humans is also dehumanizing. And when I encounter pure brutality that just doesn't make any sense and have a kind of similar response, like a really brutal, violent crime I referred to earlier, to me, I feel brutalized and dehumanized by that crime because then I become violent in response. I want to deal with that particular individual excessively and forget that, really forget the virtue of restraint in such a situation. I mean, there's violence. Eating is an act, I mean, we could argue that eating is an act of violence because we have to kill in order to eat.
I didn't have to do this.
But
some cow gave a lot over.
Well, I mean, somewhere there is a. Yes. But I'm thinking. So the criteria for violence is excess. Is excess. And humans are more capable of that than any creature, and that's why I want to extend the discussion to the natural world.
The poem that Paul did tonight on the stage, and one of the terms from the poem was, he had been educated, or he had been raised, that when you see this kind of a snake, you kill it. You know, many of you must have been here. And it was not till the very end of the poem that he actually takes up the rock and, you know, tries to kill the snake. And the line that I remember, maybe it's more to it, I'm sure it is, but it's in our, it's how we're brought up. Part of our bringing up is, if you see something dangerous, you want to do away with it. And is that a one that is killing something?
Is that a Christian upbringing or a non-Christian upbringing? That's maybe kind of the question. Is that kind of behavior? Is that
survival?
But is that somehow central to Christian or not?
The poet was wrestling with that as being. Why should I kill this? This is a living creature. He hasn't done anything to me.
So would that be the Christian response, or would it not be? That's what I'm not sure about. Because when you talk of Christian violence, what is the violent Christian and what is the violent human being? Is there a distinction?
What do you think? Do you think there's a distinction?
I'm just not sure. I think there are things in the Christian tradition, not necessarily in the Christians, you know, the Christ. I think it's quite clear that Christ is non-violent, and the early Christian community is non-violent. But I think there are some violence that has happened in the world in maybe the last 1,500 years, I think, and it has some distinctly Christian dimension to it. I think it's hard to put a finger on.
Yes, I think the excess of violence, you know, just the pure overkill I was talking about earlier, Christianity helps us, gives us the, and to me that's it's really troubling that might be human nature, just that. And yet Christianity gives us a way of restraining that. And maybe that's the distinction. There is, within the gospel, the potential for us to restrain that kind of behavior, to refrain from violence rather than give in to it. And that's where I think the distinction is. Now, we are going to commit violent acts, even as Christians, and we are going to respond in excessive ways, but in the Christian message is restraint. That might be the difference.
So you're using Hitler as sort of one of the examples of how people had to respond violently to stop him. I'm thinking, you know, there could have been ways to stop that whole movement if people had taken action. Think about, wasn't it the Danish people who all wore the gold star so that no one could know who was Jewish, which was a very, you know, active resistance against the evil that was going on that saved many people's lives without having to shoot a gun. So if there had been a mass movement where people in Europe had tried to protect those who Hitler's regime was trying to kill, it might not have ever gone as far as it did. I mean, when I look at that whole period of history, I go, how could so many thousands of people be killed and nobody do anything about it?
With the actual acquiescence of a lot of Christians.
Which goes back to fear, that mm-hmm. fear of other cultures, fear of people who are different than ourselves. And so when we're afraid, we think, well, we'll let them do that. At least it's not, I'm not pulling the trigger. I'm not turning out the gas.
There's another element, and that's the element of risk to other members of your own family and things like that. I mean, if you're going to draw on the example of the Holocaust, one of the things that's true is that a lot of people wouldn't put their own family at risk, whereas they themselves, if they had only themselves to put on the line, they might have done it. But had it been, you know, that it was their entire family that could suffer for it, that made them think twice. The people who actually put themselves at risk, you know, kind of did it for all kinds of different reasons. I think that the people in the Scandinavian countries and the people, you know, on the westernmost edge of Europe had a different relationship with Jewish people than the people in the Ukraine or the people in Poland or the people even in Eastern Germany. So, you know, there's a lot of historical reason. It's real easy for us to kind of wonder why they didn't get up, and it surely sounds like the right thing to do, but when you think about it, would you have the courage to do that? That's incredible, you know.
Well, there was a lack of a sense of community bonds then, because if you're in a strong community, you can stand together, but if you're one individual against them, you can't. If your individual's trying to respond, it's not going to be effective.
That's the first idea I've heard in terms of like how one can make a difference. In a sense, you're saying collaborate. Mm-hmm. With other people, so that there's strength and that you have support to take whatever stand.
But that's insidious. I mean, what you're talking about is all of this grew very slowly. It didn't happen overnight. You know, it wasn't one massive thing immediately. It happened very slowly. And I think one of the things that we have to watch in today's society is the very same kinds of roots that could possibly take place. And I'm not saying that they necessarily are. But there are things that we as Christian people have to watch out for as far as being, you know, violent towards our fellow humans.
Well, that's, you know, the squirt gun is a perfect example. It was a terribly, terribly hot day. You know, it would have been great to turn on all the little sprinklers and let the kids just run through the sprinklers. Mm-hmm. That would have got to the fun of that. But then it grew. It was insidious. And then finally, I don't know how at some point, it stopped. I know Janet spoke with some kids. You know, she went to the source. And how did that go, by the way? Can you fill us in on what happened when you talked with Myers or Junior Myers and Ravens? And
I talked to Junior Myers and Ravens, who are, 7 to 13 years old. And the younger ones, a little bit different language than the older ones, but basically said, it was a dilemma for me that Holden was a place that represented peacemaking for me and a witness to that. And his kids were running around with these squirt guns, and I didn't know what to do about it. And so I asked him. And generally, the girls came up with lots of solutions. Let's have boundaries, let's have a time, let's have a place. Not the animals, not in people's faces. Set up kind of rules or guidelines. And then I said, boys, you haven't spoken much. And have you girls been using them? No, the boys had, the girls hadn't been. And kind of defensive, but understood what I was talking about. And basically we're saying, you know, well, it's just for fun. And it's fun to get
wet to that
and cold.
Because I mean, it is fun to be,
yeah,
to be wet.
It's fun to get wet. It's fun to get cooled off, is what they were saying. So we talked about some solutions. And I said, you know, we adults don't really remember what it's like to be a kid. Maybe some of us do, but I said that. And I said, some of us think it looks mean. And they you kind of hear that and kind of say, and it kind of looks, and some of us are afraid that maybe another day you will use a real gun. And the older kids, some of them said, well, my dad's got a real gun and it's no big deal.
Ooh, some good interesting stories.
And the younger children, all, they kind of
Oh, I see that. So it was very interesting kind of interaction. I didn't give them any rules. I wanted them to make up their own rules and or go and have a conversation amongst themselves or with the other group leaders or their parents or whatever. And I've noticed it isn't happening.
I haven't seen them out there.
But it was real interesting the kind of reactions that they had, especially, well, it's just for fun. We want to have fun. And then we kind of came up with some solutions. You know, Eric, the gardener, said you could use the sprinklers on this area. Oh, okay, well, we can do that in the afternoon. And, you know, they liked the alternatives. But there were other ways of doing it.
Other ways to have fun.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they kind of, in a sense, you broke a cycle. And I don't know when all these kids leave, what Holden will do in the future. I mean, this is probably not the first squirt gun attack you've ever had. And probably be your last.
Yeah. Now, just to bring this back to global concern, what would Jeremiah, for example, and Isaiah or Jesus say about this? I think their position is so radical, it's totally impractical. In a fallen, sinful world. And I've sometimes thought, you know, what really is the role of the church? To be that impractical? To make that kind of a witness? Or is that, to abdicate responsibility for the world? I don't have an answer to that, but I mean, that's kind of what I wrestle with.
Yeah, and it's a tough call. Because it doesn't make sense in terms of...
Jeremiah and Isaiah would say, trust God, God will work things out. So you could say, what would have happened if we wouldn't have stopped Hitler? I think Jeremiah would say, God would have taken care of that. But that's such a radical trust. I don't think it's...
Really, well, you take that to the logical end, of course, even personally, even with our families. If we trust the cross, the resurrection, what do we have to fear? You can hear myself say it, it's nuts, but what do I have to fear if somebody would violently take the life of one of my children? We sing that every end of October, don't we? Yeah.
Mighty Fortress?
Yeah.
You think of that? Help me on the line.
Okay. Goods honor child or spouse,
life
be wrenched away, they cannot win the day, the kingdom is ours forever. Death is not the worst thing that can happen to us.
And I know it's not the worst thing that can happen to my children. I know that. But to imagine that kind of situation is, I just can't.
You said God would take care of it, but how does God take care of things? Our hands, our mouths, our actions. God works through us.
But maybe our witness would not have to be violent. It's fine.
No, it wouldn't necessarily have to be.
I think it's impractical. I just finished reading Boris Yeltsin's book. He calls it The Struggle for Russia. And he's the president at that time, or now too, of course, of Russia. But he says he has undergone two coup attempts, one in 91 and one in 93. And through the book he argues, we have to reject the communist Soviet system of oppressing people by violence and threatening the world with violence. We have to learn to talk together and find ways of coming to agreement without the use of violence. And so he denounces the people who raised the coup against him. And then Chechnya happens, and what? He's forced into a position of having to use violence. So politically, it doesn't seem practical to have an ideal that you're going to renounce violence. You get pushed into positions where it seems to be the only practical thing to do. It's like our civil war.
It's really the most impractical thing you can ever do. You know, it's the short term and long term of this. The last bit of this discussion, I'm reminded, again, this wonderful book by Jesus scholar Marcus Bohr, when he talks about the mission of Jesus. He said the one thing that was that was so clear in Jesus' mission was the substitution of a spirituality and a politics of compassion against the conventional wisdom, which operated under a spirituality and a politics of holiness. In other words, here's the law, here's all the rules, here, we're the good guys, there's the bad guys, rigid hierarchy, very tightly knit little society. And Jesus said, this is bullshit. This is nothing. My message is that this is garbage. And so I think a lot of the problems that the church has, you know, gotten into and out of over the years, one thing we got to keep the larger context that Christians have probably done greater nonviolent actions than, you know, anybody on earth, in the last, even in this country in the last 200 years, whether it's the abolitionists or civil rights movement or anti-Vietnam movement, they're all led by Christians. But it seems that when Christians get into that, you know, when they get away from their compassion into their holiness routine, you know, then we're in big trouble. You know, then we're in big trouble.
We have a few minutes left, and I just want to give an opportunity for anyone who hasn't had a chance to say, and also Walt, since you're a theologian, if you have a